All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Quick heads up here. We're going to get ready to record. We're doing 2 hours today, or until we run out of questions. The first hour is the power hour, so line up your questions for that right now. Still plenty of room to get through, but that hour usually fills up pretty quick. So if you've got a question about engines, performance, troubleshooting, whatever it might be, fuel mileage, press 1 on your phone right now. And we'll get to you. And then in the second hour, we'll be doing just general questions. And lots of time for you to get through right now, but the calls are starting to roll in. The longer you wait, the harder it is to get through. So press 1 on your phone right now, and I'll keep you updated on where we are as far as calls as we go. Let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. You name it, we'll tackle it here on this show. All you have to do is pick up the phone and ask the question. Today is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, we've got Bruce and Ethan and John. And I'm going to bring those guys in and see what it is they want to start off with this week. So, hey, guys, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey there. So, Bruce, what's on the agenda this week? What's going on over at Pittsburgh Power these days?
Oh, we're working on some Detroits that other people built that are vibrators. And we just want to tell people, whoever builds your engine, you really, really, really should have them balance the rods and the pistons.
So
and that's all I
the
have.
First time
I'm sure, John.
Well, let me. I'll jump in there, and then we'll give those two a chance to start off with something. Bruce, the first time I saw that was when you and I built that first signature engine, and I came over to Pittsburgh, and I was just watching the video again the other day, so it's kind of interesting that you brought this up. And if I remember right, wasn't it when we took the 6 connecting rods out of that one engine, weren't they, was it 100 grams difference in weight?
Yeah, we just had another one. John was telling me this morning it was 100 grams difference.
Wouldn't it be almost impossible for that engine to run smooth having those connecting rods weigh that much different?
Absolutely. Sometimes we take 18 rods to get 6 that'll balance. The problem is we went to the world economy, where all the parts are coming from all places of the world. Sometimes you'll get 2 connecting rods from Brazil, 2 from Singapore, 2 from China, 2 from Mexico. And I don't think that the people are keeping in touch with each other in the different continents and letting everyone know what the actual balance should be or the weight of the rods should be. You know, they have these plus and minus tolerance.
You know,
so I think that's where we are.
Yeah, the other thing that I saw, I knew a guy who sold tool and die mostly to truck and auto manufacturers, and he went through and he showed me how when you run a part on a tool or a die, the first one is virtually perfect. It's exact spec, and then they all start to go downhill from there, just from wear on the parts and the machines, and by the time they're ready to replace it again, the tolerances were way off. You know, and I think that almost explains why sometimes you get a vehicle or a truck, and it's just one you want to keep forever because everything seems to work right, and then you get one of those vehicles where nothing works right. And you think, how does this happen? You know, it's the same factory, same people, same everything just about. But I guess the wear and tear on the tools and the machines and the dies, you know, they have a life. And when they get down to the end of their life, you're not getting those close tolerances anymore.
You know, back in 2003 when the MBN Bridge Cat came out, and it was just plagued with problems and head gasket failures and what they called sunken liners. You know, how does a liner sink when it's already on sitting on the top of the block? But figure that was the last run of that engine before they went to the A-cert. And I always thought maybe the machines are just wore out, but they figured they would just prolong it to get through the MBN to get to the BXS A-cert. And that's what my thoughts were in 2003 and 2004, and here you just said that.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because we know that just in the normal life cycle of that machine or tool, you're going to have that problem. And you're right, that makes a lot of sense. I bet they were looking ahead saying, boy, we got to finish out this run. Why replace all this stuff now? Just get it out of here.
And, you know, everything has a plus and minus tolerance. Years ago, whenever Cummins had the VT50 turbo and the ST50 turbo with the aluminum bearing housing, that started in the small cam and then went on into the big cam. And I used to rebuild 2 to 3 of those a day. And you would mic everything, and everything would be within spec, and you put the turbo together, and you'd push on that turbine wheel, and you would hear the compressor wheel just touch the housing. And, I mean, it's not even on the truck. It's still on the bench. So you take it back apart, and you mic it, and you put it back together. Everything's within spec, but you have plus and minus tolerances, just like you do on flow rates of injectors. So what I would do is I'd separate that turbine wheel went in a different turbo, the bearing housing, the compressor wheel, compressor housing. I would separate them. And guess what? Problem would disappear. So it's just have an accumulation of everything that's at the minus tolerance, and it doesn't work.
You know, it's interesting how many places that applies. When I talked to Mike Beckett about alignments, that's one of the reasons we have alignment issues, is because, you know, these shops, as long as they're working within spec, they think everything's okay, but you're out of spec here, you're out of spec there, it accumulates, and everything is close enough to be within spec, but when you add it all up together, it's not anymore, and then you've got an alignment problem, and everybody blames it on everybody else. And, you know, it's one of the I just hate to hear this from a shop. We don't know what's wrong, it's within spec.
Yeah,
but it's not working. So,
I hate that statement.
Yeah,
yeah,
when you've got 10 different
don't
things
that
are on the loose end of the spec.
Yeah.
It all adds up.
Yeah, exactly. Or the other thing we see in front ends many times is when you've got wear over time, and you go in and the shop will check each individual component and say, well, it's not that bad, it's okay. But when you add up all the components, you can't keep the truck aligned right. Even though every one component's in spec, they're all out just enough that if you add it up, you've got a problem.
Hey, it's amazing you said Mike Beckett, because I did the Mike Beckett theory last night. I just put a new steering box on my 95 Dodge after 22 years, and you have to, they say, move your drag link 3/8 of an inch. So I said, well, I'm going to do the Mike Beckett theory. I got out the string, and I wrapped it around the front tire and back around the back tire, and I set it up so the tires just touched that string, and I took that truck out for a ride. I said, my God, it's perfect. And here I did the alignment with the string. And if I had had somebody else to help me with the tape measure, I think I'd have got it. So I just dropped the truck off at the alignment shop. I told him how I aligned it after I put the new steering box on. And you know what he said to me? That might be better than what our machine is.
Imagine
why am I
that.
Paying you?
We only
yeah,
align
anyway.
Race cars with string. They align Formula One cars with string. They align Indy cars with string. That's the most accurate way to
right?
do it, believe it or not. Yep. We build fixtures that hold the string.
Yeah.
John, why don't you tell us more about that?
It's really simple, and we could do a truck the same way. I don't want to step on Mike's business here, but the way we do it on an Indy car is there's a string fixture on the front and the rear, and you've got two strings that hang off of that that are parallel to the center line of the car and equidistant from the center line of the car, and you simply measure to the wheel. And it doesn't get more accurate than that. So you could square everything up against that string, and that's it.
That's real similar to what Mike has been doing for years, and even his, you know, kind of laser alignment system that he created is really just an electronic extension of string. You know, it's not anything really that complicated. It's using the same theory as that string does. And it's amazing. The first time I saw him do that, align a truck in the parking lot with some duct tape, a tape measure and string, I thought, there's no way. You know, because I had been used to going to shops where they have these big, expensive, digital machines, and they give you the printout. And yet I'd pull out of those places and nothing would ever be right. Truck's still pulling. I'm getting funny tire wear. First time I saw Mike, he did his thing, and it was absolutely perfect. Why do we overcomplicate things like that?
It's not even as close. I all my personal vehicles I do on my own with, I've built makeshift fixtures, but I'll make two rods that are same in length, and I'll have one at each end of the car, and I'll hang it off the car, and I'll center it with the car, and then measure it to the wheel, and it's done. Doesn't change.
Crazy. All right. Hey, I've got to get to a break. We are going to get to some questions here pretty quick, so stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. Kevin Rothbard. Welcome back. This is the Power Hour. Joining me today, Bruce and John and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power. We're going to get to your calls. Hey, John and Ethan, anything you guys want to throw out there before we get to some calls? Oh, you know what? It would probably help if I actually pressed the button and let you guys talk. You would almost think I know what I'm doing here. How about now?
Hey, I'll try that again there. We actually had a visit today from some of the reps from BorgWarner dropped us off something that we want to play with a little bit there. It's a turbo we want to try there on the 12.7 liter Detroits. Definitely different than what we've been using, so I was kind of looking forward to trying that on a truck there today. You know, maybe not today, probably a little bit later in the week.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing the results next week then.
Oh, yeah, we'll definitely have it by then. Just to see what it does and compare the two. You always got to keep looking out for better things out there.
That's right. All right, we've got lots of calls lined up. Let's jump into some. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Gunner, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for taking my call. Hey,
what's on your mind today?
I got some oil consumption issues here. I bought my truck. It's a glider kit, 07 Coronado with a 12.7. It had about 723,000 miles on it when I bought it. Used about a gallon of oil when it was on mineral oil. I switched it over to synthetic, and then it started using about 2 gallons of oil. And then I had that for about a year, and it held on. And just recently here, it started consuming oil like mad. It's not like mad for some people, but it went from a gallon every 10,000 to about a gallon every 2,000.
Wow. What's your total miles on the engine now?
819 right now.
819, and you bought it when it had how many?
723. So I put about 90 on it.
Do you have the maintenance records from the previous owner?
I do not.
So you don't know what the – how about oil analysis? Do you know what your silicone level is?
Yes, I have low silicone levels. I was going to send I do mine through Altifer, not through Polaris. But, no, I don't have silicone issues. I did once, but I had an overhead done in a dusty area, and that's all that was.
Okay. Well, if you know, the rule is a gallon in 3,000 miles is considered wore out, so it sounds like it's time you need a set of cylinder kits and a head and rod and main bearings put in that engine.
Bruce, any idea why the consumption jumped so fast?
You know, I don't know, but it seems like a person will be at a gallon in 8,000, and then the next thing you know, they're at a gallon in 6,000, and then all of a sudden it's 4, then 3, and so once it starts, it's accelerated. John, do you have any thoughts on that, why that happened?
If it happened that rapidly, though, he might want to take a look at his turbo and a few other things before he does jump into the major.
Well, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, I've done exhaust manifolds 3 times, a turbo, thermostats 3 times. I've done a bunch of stuff to it recently. I was also in your shop, Bruce. You guys put a tune on there because what I had a tune from a different place and it was really rich. I would wet stack like crazy. I came in and you guys turned me down. I'm still putting out huge power with it. You know, it doesn't feel like a worn out engine. I think I'm at 600 horsepower with 1850 torque at the wheels.
What kind of engine is it?
It's a 12.7.
Okay.
Let's make sure there's not an issue somewhere else.
It's silver.
Why 3 Sorry. Exhaust manifolds?
Because I couldn't afford to buy the nice one from Pittsburgh Power, and I was out in the middle of nowhere, and so they put regular exhaust manifolds back in, and that, of course, had to join. And so I went in another place, and they took it apart, put it back together. They did that 3 times. So,
well, here's the problem with the stock Detroit manifold. They'll leave as much as a 9,000th interference fit between the male and the female section, and they think that it's going to heat up and expand that much, but it doesn't. So that's why we have a 3,000th interference fit in our manifold, and that's how we eliminate that leak.
Right. Yeah, and that's on my list, but with all the repairs I've done lately, that's going to have to wait.
And you just recently replaced your turbo as well?
Yeah. As soon as I did my exhaust manifold, I started having an oil leak out the back of it.
Let's make sure the new one's not also leaking oil. You want to get in there and you make sure there's no evidence of oil making its way out the exhaust side or in through the intake.
Oh, okay.
And if you're
composite, the best way to do that, just pop clamps off?
Yeah, pop the clamps off on the compressor side and make sure that it's dry and nice and dry in there, or pull the exhaust off and just feel inside of there to make sure that it's not wet with oil.
Okay.
I'm always suspect of new parts. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
Whatever you do, whoever builds it, make sure they balance the rods and the pistons.
Let's head off to Chicago. Bob, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And my question is that I have a 2000 Volvo with Detroit Series 60 engine, and I would like to be able to run California. And then I was kind of hoping that Bruce may be able to help me to install that, to retrofit the engine, to install that filter, so I'll be able to go to California.
We are in the process. We had our first phone meeting this past week with an aftermarket DPF company, that is Calip. So we have, what they asked us to do is to gather how many owner-operators that we would be able to install them on, and they want to see that we're going to do more than 10 or 12 a year, and we assured them that it would be much greater than that. So what you need to do is call our shop and give us your name, address, and phone number so we can put you on the list. And then next week or within the next 2 weeks, we'll be calling them back again.
But okay, yes. Go ahead and ask for me when you call. Ask for John when you call. I'm going to be compiling that data to try to get some sort of projection to these folks to get set up with them. So please go ahead and ask for me, and I'll take your info and add it to my database.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much.
And this goes for everybody that's listening, that if you have a 2002 and older and you want to run California, we may be able to help you within the next couple months, but we need some information from you now.
Hey, Bruce, if you guys, if somebody from the shop will send me over what you need, we'll do an email blast out as well and get some response back.
Fantastic. We'll do that.
Terrific, Kevin. I'll get that to you.
Okay, excellent. And another question on that. Are there any requirements on the engine? I know when I was looking into it a while back, they were looking at, you know, oil consumption and soot levels and telling, I've heard them tell some people, we can't put a DPF on that till it has an in-frame. Any information on that?
They say that it's fuel and oil that clog the DPF filter. So the more your oil consumption is, the more often you'll have to have the DPF cleaned.
Got it.
The product we're looking at regens at a very low temperature, so it's pretty forgiving. They actually call it passive. So the chances of this one clogging on you are pretty slim. It still will need to be cleaned, you know, from time to time, but they didn't seem to have any issues with us installing them on the older engines.
Got it. Good. Well, we'll look. We'll get some information out. We'll look forward to hearing back on some of those things. Let's go to Texas. Kirk, welcome to the program.
Howdy, guys. I have two problems. One of them, I got off the side of the road just now, which was me. I was going down the road. It degraded itself. I lost fuel pressure, I'm not sure, but I did unplug the line off the fuel pressure switch, replugged it back in. The cruise control switch was giving me trouble. Now it's not working at all. Could that have been the problem? Fuel pressure switch or cruise control switch?
Guys, before you jump in and answer that, we're coming up on the break, so give that a couple minutes thought, and we will come right back after the break, and we'll talk about that. If you haven't been to the website recently, or you haven't been to the website, check it out. We've always got new stuff going on, and now is no exception. We are posting webinars as we get them done, and we're going to work on some more of those. If you want to stay informed on things like we were just talking about, anything new coming from us or our partner companies, we'll get it out to you in an email. All you have to do is get on the email list. Real easy to do. Check out letstruck.com. Bottom left corner of the homepage, you'll see a sign up for the newsletter. And we'll keep you in the loop, let you know what's going on. We're going to get to more Power Hour calls right after this. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It is the Power Hour. Joining me today, Bruce and Ethan and John from Pittsburgh Power, and we were talking with Kirk in Texas. So, John, I think you were getting ready to either give him an idea or ask a question. Go ahead.
Ethan's on that one. Let him take this one.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Start with asking what engine are we working on here.
ISX.
Okay, yeah, the ISX does have fuel pressure, you know, it actually cares about the fuel pressure there. If it lost the fuel pressure signal or if your pump's giving you a problem, yeah, it could just shut you down there.
Okay, and then what was blowing my mind, the cruise control switch started giving trouble on resume. Now it's going down the road, you can't even set it.
That could just be a bad switch. I don't think the two problems are related in any way there.
Okay. But I will pick up another fuel pressure sending unit. And problem number two, another ISX. They went ahead and changed it. Wasn't getting no boost pressure to start off with. They went ahead and changed the compressor. They thought it was it. The turbo speed sensor, and they put an air pressure after the turbo through the air to air, and it's blowing through the air dryer. Could that be a problem in the air dryer? Because he still doesn't have boost pressure.
That's why when we test the entire charged air system. Because we find that the air can find its ways in places where you would at least expect it. Air compressors themselves can actually cause a boost leak once they get old and wear out. Several times we've seen bad compressors, that are run off the intake manifold turbocharged air, go bad.
Okay.
Several years ago, air dryer, right?
The air dryer is part of that system. I mean, it would have to fail in an interesting way, but I'm going to say it's definitely possible.
Yeah, because I'm starting to feel I can't even boost up the engine RPM, so my switch is bad. I pulled over again.
Bendix Westinghouse made several years ago an auxiliary valve that we used to put on to keep the compressed air from the turbocharger from going through the air dryer. And if you would call our shop and ask for Pete, he could tell you about that Bendix Westinghouse switch valve, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
So call and
Pete.
Ask for Pete. Pete.
Okay. Just wrote that down. And I sure appreciate it, guys.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Why don't you touch on what we've been doing with the smoke machine, some of the different tests that you've come up with, and what we've found?
Well, I've been primarily used for testing for boost leaks, which is great. It's a great tool for that. We found so many, people come in with a power issue, and it turns out they've just got a boost leak. And the smoke machine makes it really easy to find that. Quite often it's a charge air cooler or a hose or a clamp that you think is tight but isn't, and so forth. So we've done a lot with that and helped a lot of people in that regard. I mean, they think they've got a big problem. It's simply a boost leak, and it's easy to find with a smoke machine. Last week we had a job in the shop that was we had a leaky injector tube on one head on an old N14, and we'd already had the other injectors out, and the water was already out, and the mechanic said, "Well, how do I check the other ones?" I'm like, "Well, we'll hook the smoke machine up to the cooling system." And he did, and we found it. We had three other ones that had smoke coming out of the injector tubes. So that was a quick way to find that problem. And I had one of the mechanics last week also use it on an oil leak. We had an engine was just covered in oil, so it was hard to see where it was. We'd sprayed it off with solvent, but it didn't really show. And what it had was a DDEC 5 with a hairline crack the whole way around the cam gear housing. Same deal. I had them hook it right up to the crankcase and pressurize the crankcase with the smoke machine, and there you had it. We saw the smoke weeping out of the crack in the cam gear housing. So it's a useful tool. It's a neat piece and saves a lot of time, and it really helps with troubleshooting.
Well, John, you'll love this story then, because a couple of years ago when we started using the smoke machine for the intake system, charge air cooler, all that, and we were excited because we were finding things we were never finding with the pressure test, and it was working fantastic. And I posted up on it was Facebook, and we had our forums back then, and, you know, letting everybody know, hey, here's a great way, talk to your shop, maybe they can do it, you could get your own smoke machine maybe. And I had this guy who would not stop. He called me every name in the book, said I was an idiot, said there was no way this worked. He tried it. It was impossible to get the smoke all the way through the system. And the guy didn't stop for like 3 months. I mean, he was just obnoxious about this. And I kept saying, I don't know what you're doing wrong. We do this virtually every day, and we're finding leaks all over the place.
Yeah, it's a wonderful machine. A friend of mine's got an auto repair, and everybody with a car has had a check engine light for a loose gas cap, right, or something worse. When you get that EVAP code, it's sometimes really difficult to find with all the plastic hoses and things on modern cars. And he smoke machine does it. He plugs it into the fuel system and watches for where the smoke's coming out, and he fixes his EVAP problem immediately. So they're a really useful tool. I mean, you could use it on anything that's pressurized or holds a fluid or air or anything. It's a wonderful tool.
Yeah, I guess it. When it comes to this guy, it's like any tool. You have to know how to use it, and I don't know what his problem was, but it was just it was kind of funny how nasty he got about the whole thing. Let's. We still got some calls here. Let's head off to Philly. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? I got my engine Pittsburgh powered about almost a year ago. And my question is, Bruce, you did a pretty good job on the engine, no problems with it. My question is, what's the approximate life expectancy if all the maintenance is done the right way for the duration after the in-frame, approximately?
What engine is it?
ISX.
Okay, what year?
The engine is an 06.
Okay, well... Are you doing a 15,000 mile oil change?
Well, yeah, I did do oil changes when I that you told me right after I got it in framed, and I've been doing it between like 15,000 and 20,000 miles since that.
Okay.
I only got good.
Are you doing oil analysis?
I did, after the initial, what was it, like the fourth oil change, I did an oil analysis. It came back okay. It's in the filing cabinet. I'm going to change the oil Thursday, and I'm going to send it out and get it done on this oil change.
Okay.
I haven't done it on every single oil change.
Well, if it's properly driven and properly maintained, there's no reason it doesn't go another 800 to a million miles.
Okay. Yeah, it will be maintained. I did get the fuel injectors changed. I'm still getting about 8.5 miles at a gallon on a regular basis. So.
Wow. Wow.
That's not bad.
I've kept a fuel mileage log now since you in-framed it, and I think the average is about 8.1 or 8.2 since you in-framed it.
That's phenomenal. What kind of truck?
Volvo.
Good. Every now and then you ought to stop by and let's do the engine flush treatment to it just to clean it out.
To clean what out, Bruce?
Just to clean out the engine. What's our engine flush machine called, guys?
I'm not sure the actual name of it, Bruce. That's a new one on me.
It's a Diesel Tech engine flush machine. It uses
right.
a 5-weight oil, and it pressure washes the inside of the engine with an oil that has 6 times the detergents that regular engine oil does. And whenever we do that, you'll run about 8,000 or 9,000 miles on that new oil change before it starts to get dirty. We had it at the CMC last year and did several, and we were really impressed with the results that we have. So if you'd come by once a year and do that, that would extend your engine life.
I'll tell you what I noticed. Oil just seems to be, I've been doing it, the oil change is about 20,000 miles. And since I've been changing the oil, I noticed that the oil used to be dirtier with just a lot of soot in it, and it's not as dirty.
All right, everybody, hold that thought. The music's playing. That means I've got to get to a break. We will be right back with the final segment for the Power Hour today, so stick around for that. The website is letstruck.com. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up, we're heading into the final segment. Let me scan through to see what we have for questions here. We still have some Pittsburgh Power questions we're going to get to. And right now, questions are a little too light to take a second hour. But if you just joined us, there are a lot of calls on the line. So I'm imagining we should get a lot of questions. So we will go into a second hour if we have enough questions. If you want to get in on a general, press 1 on your phone right now, and we'll get to you. I'll give you an update before we head into the second hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're heading into the final segment. Bruce and John and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power are here helping us out with questions. And before the break, we were talking with Frank in Philly. So go ahead.
Bruce, I noticed I've been changing the oil, and the oil, it does seem cleaner since you inframed it. But I'm considering putting one of those aftermarket filters that can change the canister filter on it.
Right.
Probably gonna.
Give us a call and let's talk about the OPS and the spinner too, and let's talk about what we would like you to do and how we'd like you to still maintain it after you do the bypass filtration.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, you did the inframe from the oil pan to the valve cover. I mean, the engine runs really well. The fuel mileage has been really good, but I am going to drive that truck until it needs to be inframed again. Now, do you suggest doing oil changes at 20,000 miles?
No, 15 or 20. It'd be best if we talked on the phone because I'd like to know when you burn your first gallon and then talk to you about your oil analysis. So
it never really burned too much oil.
Okay. Yeah. Let's get a bypass filter on there, and then let's see when it burns its gallon, and then let's do our oil change then.
Excellent. Let's get to some more calls, see how many we can knock out. We're off to Iowa. Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have one tip. I took the backup camera, these aftermarket backup cameras that you get for your car, and I taped the camera to my right mirror, and then I wired it direct into a cigarette lighter so I can turn it on all the time. You won't believe how good you can see at night, in the rain, and even like when you're in the snow and you can't see the white mark on the road, that camera will pick up that white mark through the snow.
Interesting.
Where do you have your display?
I have it on my dash. It's like a 5-inch display. I just bought a new one. It's a 7-inch, and it's color, and it really works good at night. I mean, when it's raining and my mirrors get all wet and stuff, that thing is clear as a bell. It's good.
Fantastic.
And it's like $40. I think the last one I got is 7-inch screen. I think I paid $59 for it, but it's worth its weight in gold for
That's
seeing cars
idea.
Coming up alongside the truck.
Good.
I just bought a 3000 or 03 Volvo with an N14 in it. It's got a light lip clutch in it, light clutch. And mm-hmm. I notice when I start out, even empty or loaded, it seems like it's jerky. Is that normal for that clutch?
No, it's not. I wonder if they put a reconditioned flywheel in it whenever that clutch was installed. That's normally the sign that nobody did the flywheel
I got all the maintenance records back to 05 on it. And they didn't say nothing about flywheel. They just said they replaced the clutch.
Yeah.
Now the next thing, the N14, I'm not really familiar with. I'm running a 60 series Detroit now. I just bought this truck for a standby truck.
Okay.
It's got a million eight on it. This is under a million one.
Okay.
It seems kind of sluggish. I've only ran it about 2,000 miles right now. What is the difference between the N14s, between the red tops and plus and that? Is it a computer thing or?
No, the Select Plus started in 98. So if you're a Select Plus, you're a 2592 or 2391 CPL, and your timing set at 0.362, which was an EPA mandated timing strictly for emissions. If you're ever in the cam followers, advance at 0.0001 to 352, and that'll help it. But you might need some fuel lines, being it's over a million miles. It just might need a good tune-up.
Yeah.
Why don't you try to get it in the shop and let's check it out?
I can't see where it's ever had an overhead done on it.
Is it a 5 1/4 horse?
It's 4 1/4, but they put a new ECM on it, and I got the readout on the ECM. It said 4 1/4, but it also had a line that said 5 1/4. So is that the topic?
Now, what's the turbo boost gauge read on a hard pull?
It doesn't have a turbo boost gauge.
I could tell you the horsepower.
Yeah.
$8, you could get a boost gauge kit and put it in and give me a call. And then I could tell you what the horsepower is, and then I can tell you what we can do to it. Or you just buy the Pittsburgh Power Box and put that on, and away you go.
Well, that's what I got on my 60 Series Detroit. I'm putting out about 7 1/4 with that.
Wow.
Everything's sluggish after that, you know.
Yeah, you're spoiled.
Oil pressure is like 35 pounds. Is that normal?
It should be 40, but there's a spring and a plunger in there that's very easy and economical to change, and it just might need that. That's in the
About putting main bearings in it or even checking them or anything?
Not till rebuild time.
Okay. Now, they say that the N14 returns a lot of fuel when it's hot. Now, I drove the M11, and it had a fuel cooler on it. Is that something I should think about putting on it?
No, what you want to do is if your fuel is 170 degrees or cooler, you're okay. So just shoot the tank in the summertime when it's hot with a heat gun.
Okay. Now, it had a new ECM put on it at one time. Would that be better to send the ECM to you? Now, I also have a scans gauge that I put on it. Will the boost gauge be on that?
Yeah, the scan gauge has a boost gauge.
Yep.
Yeah, I haven't gone. I just put it on. I took it out of my 60 series and stuck it on that. And, you know, I didn't run through the protocols to get the extra gauges and all that stuff yet or whatever. But
okay.
But it would have a boost gauge in the ECM, right?
That's correct. Can you get the truck to Pittsburgh?
No, I just run a steady haul here in Iowa. I have 2 loads a day that I on a steady run. So, like I said, I just bought the truck for a standby in case my other one went down. You know, I got another truck to use. And it was decent money. The guy put put more money in repairs in it the last year he had it than I paid for it.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Hey, we're going to try to squeeze in one more call here, Bruce. We're going to head off to North Dakota. Jake, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you all doing today?
Good. What can we help you with?
Hey, I've got a 1mm serial prefix Caterpillar in a 2000 W900 Kenworth. I've got a 18-speed with a double over, I believe, and 355 rears, 24.5 low pro tires. It's a C16, I guess, a 16-liter version. And
yeah.
I'm currently getting, it's not very much work to keep it over 6 miles a gallon, but I'd like to hit 7. And I'd like a little input on operating range on the tack on this engine. I've always been told cats are low RPM engines, blah, blah, blah. But I've also heard arguments in the other direction. So I've been running at about 1,300, 1,300 to 1,400, depending on the load.
Your RPM range is good. I'll tell you what suffers on the C16. The turbo is not a bad turbo on the C16, but the exhaust manifold is very bad. Put our exhaust manifold on, you might see upwards to a half mile of the gallon. Do you still have stock mufflers on this truck?
No, sir. The whole Kenworth U-turn system is out of it. It goes to a Y-pipe and then 6-inch stacks. Is Grand Rock, the cork screws or whatever in the pipe.
Good. Have you put our torsional damper, the crankshaft damper, and the mercury-filled engine balancer on it yet?
It has the damper on it. I don't know if it's Pittsburgh Power damper, but I think the guy that I bought the truck from had it put on at your shop, so whatever that is.
Okay.
And also, yes, it does have the balancer on it. I do.
Okay,
that's about five, maybe over 600,000 miles ago, though. So I don't know. Do the balancers wear out? I know the dampers do.
The damper's good for 500,000. The balancer's good for life. So you need another torsional damper. Do the manifold, the damper, and the fast fuel system, and you might see that steady 6 mile of the gallon plus that you're looking for. Or was it 7 you're looking for?
Yeah, it was 7. And, guys, the music's playing. We've got to go. Hey, Jake, if you go into fuel gauges and look up Signature 379, you'll find a truck with that same engine, 379 instead of a W9. Matt maintained over 7 on the lifetime of that vehicle over a lot of miles. So check out what he's done with his. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you back here next week on the Power Hour. Thanks to everybody from Pittsburgh Power. Look them up, give them a call, and we'll see you next time. Be safe, be profitable. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, everybody, we're getting set up here to do another show. We've got lots of questions on the line right now. So looks like we're just going to go ahead and get started. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome back, or welcome to the show. Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We never have a lot of time here during the week when the show's only an hour. So I'm going to get right to calls tonight and see how many we can knock out. Let's head out to Minnesota. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I had a glider 2013 Peterbilt with a
Cab Zixen Z, and she burnt up on me, and I want to do another glider, and she got pretty hot, and I want to know what kind of things to look for in that Cab Zixen Z. The ECM started on fire, went right into the, well, that's got a plastic cover with a block, burnt a hole in there. And my adjuster said I should be concerned about the cylinder or the piston melt or weld into the cylinder. I don't think it got that hot, but I think it will turn over, and the hood burnt and burnt a hole in the valve cover, and I'm going to try it, but what kind of things should I be looking for?
Wow.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah, heat from a fire, especially on a vehicle, there's a lot of very combustible materials that burn really hot. Rubber, plastic, fiberglass, fuel. It can get pretty darn hot in a vehicle fire, and the heat could do damage. So what are you doing? You're just going to take this truck that's all burnt up and rebuild it, I guess? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, I'm planning on getting a glider, another glider, just the same specs I got. Just put this engine and drivetrain in there. So I know the tranny rear ends are fine. It's just the engine that got all the heat. So.
Got it. So the good news is, since you're pulling the engine out and putting it in another truck, it's going to be pretty easy to inspect this thing. So I would just make sure you're working with a good engine shop that knows what happened, and it's obvious what happened, and just let them know that you want to be sure that anything that may have been damaged by the heat gets looked at before we drop this thing back into another truck.
Okay, yeah, it's got 310,000 miles on, so I don't want to overhaul it or anything. But well, the computer's fried, too. Can I just go to Pittsburgh Power and buy one of them power boxes, or do I still need an ECM?
Yeah, you would need an ECM. So your choice would be, go to Pittsburgh Power and let them custom program the ECM for you, which is what I did with mine, or basically start with a pretty stock clean ECM and then put the power box after it. The power box is after the ECM. So the ECM sends the signal out, the power box alters that signal. So
okay.
Yeah, you can go either way. Really just depends on what you're trying to accomplish. For example, on mine, I knew I didn't want a lot of horsepower. I didn't want a lot of torque. I was the same weight all the time. And I could just kind of tweak the ECM to be the way I wanted it. The beauty of the power box is you can go anywhere from 0, which is stock, up to 7, which is crazy amounts of horsepower and torque, and you can put it wherever you want it. If you're heavier, you can turn it up a little more. If you're in really bad weather and bad roads, you can turn it off so you don't have the power and the torque. So the flexibility of the power box is nice, but you can also tune an ECM so it'll run really well.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what I have ahead of me. It's a big process.
Yeah, there you go. Let me call us back. Let us know how that's going. Let's head off to New Jersey. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I want to go over that oil sample I got here this week.
All right, so let's take a look. This is a 60 series. What year?
2000.
Okay, and looks like about 810,000 on the engine and 41,000 on the oil. Is that correct?
Yes, Bob.
All right, yep. So we're starting to see some things that make me wonder a little. We're borderline on fuel dilution. Do you idle a lot?
Idled a ton this last 3 weeks. I was up below 20 degrees, down to minus 10 or 15 the whole time. So northern tier. So, New England to North Dakota.
Got it. Since the fuel dilution is borderline and you've been idling a lot, I would say that we're not going to tear into things trying to find it yet. How much oil are you consuming?
I am consuming about a gallon every 4 to 4,500 miles. So I'm in the planning stages for an in-frame now.
Well, then the rest of this makes sense, because with that kind of blow-by, if you're burning that much oil, that means the oil's getting past the rings and being burnt, but it also means that combustion gases are getting past the rings into the oil, and that's what's causing the high oxidation. So that makes sense. We're starting to see some bearing wear.
The base was okay. That's why I figured it had to be getting by the rings is why we're getting the oxidation, because the base is still at over 4, you know. I think it had to be some reason why the oxidation. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of getting old. I'm not getting as good a fuel economy right now. However, I have been rolling along pretty strong. Even on E-Logs, doing 3,900 miles a week. So I've been driving 65 because I had a lot of tight scheduling for 2 or 3 weeks there too. So, I was going to ask you about the. I'm a little bit up high on the lead, a little bit high on the iron also, yeah. So both of those kind of lead me to believe that if I do my summertime in-frame this year, that might be about the right timing. Is that correct?
Yeah, you'll be okay till summer. Know what I would start doing? I would change this oil when you get a chance. Not a huge hurry, but if it hasn't been changed, I would change it. And I would throw a gallon of Lucas in when you do your changes.
And you see my viscosity's up a little bit. I put a gallon in at 41,000 ago when I changed it, and I put either 1 or 2 gallon cents instead of a gallon of oil, because I remember one time it was in the cold weather. You cannot get Lucas to come out of the bottle in cold weather. I found that out. I had to put it on top of the valve covers for a while to warm it up.
Yeah, that's a great illustration. When we talk about healthy engines, and I say don't put anything in them, don't put Lucas in there, don't put anything in there. If the engine's healthy, put a good quality synthetic oil. If the engine is getting, you know, towards the end of its life, or we have fuel dilution or coolant, gallon of Lucas can really protect the engine. But go out some day when it's below zero. Take a gallon of synthetic oil and take a gallon of Lucas and try pouring them, and then think about what's going on inside your engine. So for you, though, right now, gallon of Lucas is a great idea.
Okay, yeah. We'll get it done this summer. Won't be done by the CMC, but, shortly thereafter. I'm planning a week of vacation at the beach, and so that's a good time to do it. I'll be down anyhow, but...
There you go. That's the way I like to see it. You track the numbers, you watch what's going on, you plan ahead. Just makes so much more sense. Why sit around in a hotel somewhere stressing about your truck in the shop when you could be laying on the beach letting somebody else work on it? Let's go to... Oh, you know what? We're going to get to a break. I'm looking at the clock, and I don't want to rush this next call, so we're going to run it into a break, and when we come back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. If you don't have your tax return done yet, it is past time. You need to get it done. So if you have somebody that you're very happy with and they do owner operators and drivers, and you are confident they're doing it right, then get into them. Get an appointment. Get in and get this done. Don't put it off. If you don't have anybody you're in love with doing your tax return, or if you're wondering if maybe somebody who specializes in owner operators might be able to save you some money, then give us a call. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835, or go to the website letstruck.com. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to head up to New York for the next call. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir, for taking my call. This is kind of directed towards Bruce and that crew because they will be seeing the truck here shortly. When I bought the truck in June, I could drive it like I stole it, and I would get 6.5 to 7.5 miles to the gallon. If I drove it like grandma, I would get up to like 8, 8.25, which is great.
Okay.
In September, on September 10th, I was climbing through Massachusetts. The truck started running really rough, like I had dropped an injector. And when I took it into Cummins up there, they turned around and they told me that my crankshaft had broken. So we looked at the options of buying a used motor, having it rebuilt, and everything else. Well, I decided to go with a reconditioned motor. Now, that's been almost 50,000 miles ago. Right now, I cannot get any better than 5.5 on a normal basis, and I'm even down like 4 or 5.25 to 4.75 on a normal basis.
Ouch. Okay. What year was the engine?
It's a 2005.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the things we know when we're talking about fuel economy, there's lots and lots and lots and lots. Did I say lots? Lots of factors that affect fuel economy. Aerodynamics, tires, you know, mechanical resistance in the driveline, on and on and on. And then there's the engine and all of the different aspects of what the engine is doing as well. Well, this is one of those cases where we know the only thing that got, or maybe we don't, I'll ask to be sure, but the only thing that got changed was the engine, right?
That is correct. I'm still running X-Line E Energies, XDA3s on the front.
Yeah, so you're the same driver. The truck is the same truck. The freight is basically the same freight. And all that changed was the engine. So we know exactly where we need to focus to figure out the problem, and it's the engine. So, you know, we would still do things like, you know, test the intake air system to make sure that when everything got put back together, we didn't end up with a leak somewhere there. That's pretty simple. Check the overhead. Have you done any oil analysis on this engine yet?
Yes, I have two of them, and I'll call you back in a regular show and look at that. My soot levels are down. My fuel dilution, there isn't any. Actually, they look very normal.
You know, if the oil sample looks normal, then we start looking at things like fuel pressure boost. You know, what can happen is an engine can run well below optimal horsepower and torque without causing any soot or fuel issues, but it's struggling so hard that it just kills fuel economy. So there's no question the most qualified shop in the country to figure this out would be Pittsburgh Power.
Well, I also have one more question. As far as
sure.
the programming the computer, I do not know who the guy took the truck to before and he had the computer programmed. But when I sent in the core engine, that computer went back with it. So I ended up with a whole new computer. But my question to, I guess it would be Ethan, I think he's the one that works on the computers, is if I go to a junkyard and I pick up a ISX 450 computer, can we make this work on this, for this truck with their flash program? Or does it have to be exactly set up for the same motor?
No, they you know, a computer, for the most part, there are some differences in years and things like that, but for the most part, it's kind of a blank slate. We get to program it. It's just sitting there waiting for somebody to program it to tell it what to do. So give them a call. They'll go through all your options with you, but there should be no reason why we can't get this back to where you were, or very close. As long as the engine isn't really worn out, if we don't have a lot of blow-by, that kind of thing, it's just a matter of tweaking what's going on there. Let's go to Kansas City. Darius, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with today?
I think you should have a contract in front of you, hopefully. Just want to see if you have a minute to take a quick look at it. I'm looking at a few companies, and it looks like a fairly simple contract, but just want to see if you see any red flags right away.
You know, I can glance at it pretty quick, but it is simple, I can say that, but it's also, it's also 30 pages of legalese, so not really something that I could give any real attention to while I'm on the air. I could take a look at it later, but I'm actually, who have you talked to over at this carrier? Anybody?
Just a couple recruiters, and then been reading on the trucker report, you know, about them. That's about it.
What are you hearing? What are you hearing so far?
Really good things. I mean, from the few people that have been with them with about 3 years now, two teams and a single driver, really good thing, you know, really good things. Just 5 years, you know, they've done amazing things, it looks like, from get-go. So it's kind of,
yeah,
I was kind of, you know, surprised.
I've had some communication with the owners of this company, and I was very impressed. You know, I can't say that I've ever had a truck there, but I have had some communication with the owners. I was very, very impressed with what they were doing, and it sounds like the feedback you're getting is positive. That's a good sign. And I will tell you, one of the things, it's interesting. I used to do a lot of speaking at industry events, TCA, ATA, all kinds of different groups, state associations. And one of the things that came up was, you know, carriers being sued over all kinds of things. And I can remember being at a meeting one day, and the speaker was an attorney that represented a lot of fleets, and he walked into the meeting room and he put a scale on the table and he took out a bunch of contracts from carriers, just like what you're looking at here. And he said, I don't need to read these. I don't need to read these to know whether or not they will protect you as a carrier. Now, remember, he's addressing carriers at this meeting. He said, here's all I need to do. And he would take a contract and he would lay it on the scale. And he would say, nope, too light, and he would throw it away.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
that's what the industry has come to, because carriers got tired of being sued, so they just write these crazy complicated contracts that protect them against everything and do nothing for you, the owner-operator. This one, even though I said it's 30 pages, this is short. This is short and sweet and simple, and that's it. Now, when I started in the business, 2 pages. Most of the contracts I signed back then were 2 pages. So, you know, 30 sounds like a lot, but not in comparison to what we see a lot of times. This, from what I could gather, and all I could do was kind of run through the headings a little bit and some of the amendment or addendums, and I'm not seeing anything. This is a pretty straightforward contract.
Okay, well, great. I mean, the fact that you know about him and you've talked to him, that, you know, when what you say, that says a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
like I say,
well,
I was impressed. They are a fairly new company, and they've done some pretty amazing things. So, you know, continue doing what you're doing. You're checking on forums. You're asking other people. You're asking me. That's how you start to get a whole picture. You know, if you hear from two or three people that this is a great carrier, yeah, that's good news, but it's not really telling me much. You know, you're doing the right thing. You're asking in different places. And if you start to get an overall positive picture, that's a good thing. Now, how far away are you from their offices?
Well, the only office I know of is Chattanooga, I guess. I'm in Kansas City. Well, right now I'm in Texas. But
yeah.
I do drive through there every once in a while, so that's my next step, is actually swinging by there eventually.
Yep, absolutely. You know, that is one of it, and it's amazing to me how few owner-operators do that. Now, I get it. We're in an industry where we deal with people all over the country, and we get used to doing things on the phone and through email and things like that. That's how we do business. But this is a big decision. Before I would ever sign on with a carrier, if I had to get on a plane and fly to go meet the people I'm going to deal with every day before I sign the contract, before I quit what I'm doing now, that's what you should go do. So sounds like you've got an opportunity to go do that, and I would highly recommend it. Congratulations on doing the hard work, by the way. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothbard. Welcome back. During the break, Matt just reminded me of one of my favorite questions, and this is in the book I wrote about getting started as an owner-operator, because some of the things I cover in that book are finding a carrier. Well, the book is valuable even to people who have been owner-operators for years, because finding a carrier is something we may do more than once, and the same rules apply, but the question Matt reminded me of was, when you're looking at a carrier, you want to find as many as possible, that love it there and ask them why. But you also want to look for somebody who hates it and is ready to quit, or if you can find somebody who already quit, ask them why they quit. Sometimes, though, and always ask why, because sometimes the reason people do things is more telling than what they did. For example, I've asked people, well, why did you leave that carrier? Well, I just couldn't get enough miles. I can't survive on 3,000 miles a week or whatever the number is. And that may be a legitimate reason for them to quit, but what if I don't want those kind of miles? What if I do just fine on 2,500 miles a week and that's what I want to do? So ask questions, ask why to as many people as possible. Let's go to Texas. Rich, welcome to the program.
Fairfax now, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I have a couple questions. I'm looking to ditch the 2012 and the lease purchase, not because I'm unhappy. You yourself were quite impressed with my numbers. The truck honestly scares me, so I'm
okay.
Looking to go pre-emission, pre-EGR. My questions are, first of all, I'm seeing a lot of 04 through 07 14-liter Detroits, very cheap. Are those fixable?
Yes, they are.
I think you know what I mean by fixable.
Yeah, they are. It's not cheap. It's not legal. We know that. Wouldn't stop me from doing it if I had one and needed to make money with it. They are an amazing engine. Now, I don't think, though, I don't know. I'm trying to think if I would go through that, because it's really not necessary. When you say cheap, how cheap?
under 15,000.
Maybe I would. You know, the cost we could always justify. We, you know, make sure you get estimates, talk to a shop that, that is willing to do this and does it right. That's a really big one. There are lots of people fixing these engines that are not really fixing them very well. So make sure that before you commit to buying one of these, you've been through that whole process. You know how they're going to do it. You know what it's going to cost. And then it's just a numbers game. The only other factor you need to keep in mind, is that as of right now, nobody's really clamping down on the end user with one of these vehicles, but they could. There's always that potential out there that these things become, you know, a liability because they're not legal. That could be an issue. So if I had one, I would do everything I had to do to make it run right and be profitable. If I didn't have one, I don't think I would go buy one. I just don't think I would want to take on that expense and the risk when there are other options.
Okay, then that brings it to my next question. What is your opinion on the C12 engine? I've seen a couple of trucks that interested me.
I like the C12. I've seen really good fuel economy out of the C12, good performance. You know, we tend to think of that as a small engine, but it's a 12.7. I mean, we love the Series 60, and it's a 12-liter engine. We think of this as a small engine because we're just used to dealing with the 15-liter cat, but C12 is the same size as a Series 60 Detroit and pulls better. So you won't
have
any performance. Go ahead.
I would say I have a 13-liter in the Max Force now, so I'm not really looking at a size difference, is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. You know, like, when you say C12, everybody thinks small. But it's really not. I mean, it's just smaller than the, you know, the 3406 or the 6NZ or the Cat we're used to dealing with. But it's not really a small engine by comparison to most other engines. And like I say, this is one of the cats that I actually see pretty good fuel economy out of.
I have another question about that. Everything you said, I think, might be why I'm seeing them at some of the prices. People maybe don't, like you said, oh, small engine, no good. Does it also mean that motor's slightly lighter, which makes the truck as a whole a little bit lighter?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know the weight difference, but it's got to be fairly significant.
And how, now when I do this, I'm pretty much saying the hell with California. I'm going to keep running like everybody else does until I get caught if I buy an older truck. And I'll retrofit it when I have it. And you're going to have information on how to get a hold of Pittsburgh Power, because when I'm forced to retrofit it, if I go this route, I will go to them to have it done, because I think they're probably going to be the best solution.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do, since I know that Pittsburgh Power is working on a solution, and what they need is feedback from people so they can see the demand, see what people need. I think the way we'll do this is we'll create a form. We're pretty good at that stuff here. We have a big database that we can email out to. So we'll create a form to gather the information they need, and we'll just email that form out to everybody so we can get as much feedback as possible. So if you're on our email list, I would look for that within the next week or so. I'd like to get on that.
Okay. And do you have time for one quick last question?
Sure.
You reviewed my numbers about a month ago, and I'm pretty much in a lease purchase, and I'm at 51 or 52% profit with truck payment. Is it a safe, I don't know the word I'm looking for, is it safe to say that if I'm able to succeed with a truck payment and a truck that, thank God, I've been lucky it hasn't broke down being an emission truck, that I should have the same success with a truck that's going to be more reliable, pretty much running with the same carrier? Is it
Oh, absolutely.
Almost a less,
yeah, that
no risk, no brainer situation?
Yeah, that's the beauty of having numbers. You know, because if you were just calling me and said, well, no, I don't do any bookkeeping, I think I'm doing okay, the bills are big, that doesn't tell me anything. But we could dig right into your numbers, and I remember them from your last call, and they were amazing. And we could, if we wanted to, we could sit down and start plugging in, you know, the projected new numbers. You know, we know what your truck payment is now. We could go calculate it, what it's going to be with this other truck. My guess is it's going to go down. Your insurance is going to go down, so we could plug that in. We could make a pretty good estimate of fuel economy once we know exactly what truck you're buying and what you're going to do to it, so we could plug that in. And I have a pretty good idea of what maintenance cost is on most trucks. We could plug that in. Nothing else really changes. Your revenue is not going to change. Your incidental stuff that doesn't have anything to do with the truck isn't going to change. So that's the beauty of the numbers. We could sit down and in, you know, 30 or 45 minutes, plug everything in and see exactly what's going to happen. But you had plenty of room to play with, and the changes you're making should actually make all your numbers better.
That's okay. That makes me feel better. The whole point of it is I want something that's going to cost me a little bit less to where I can afford to stay home a little bit more. Lower my
revenue,
but also lower my cost.
Well, and that's the beauty, again, of having the numbers, because all that really gets affected by this are your fixed costs. So if you just want to drive less, we can go in and look at it and say, sure, you know, knock off, 2,000 miles every month if you want, and here's how the numbers are going to change. And the other thing that you're doing here is right now your numbers looked fantastic. They really did. So there's this temptation to say, why screw with something that's working so good? But you've got that giant elephant hanging out there that is the risk of these emission trucks going south on you. And that could change
yes.
everything, because then not only do your expenses go up, your fuel economy usually goes to hell, maintenance cost goes up, but revenue usually goes down, and not by choice, because it goes down because your truck's sitting in the shop all the time. So I think it's a smart move, and your numbers look good, but I think you could make them even better or have more freedom to be home when you want, which is another important thing. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're just down to the final segment, so we're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're off to Louisiana. Tim, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. A quick side note, ask my question. I was listening to the satellite radio on Sunday. I don't know how old the show was, but a lady had called in about having IFTA problems with her carrier. When I ran with other carriers, I did my own IFTA, and I was not required to get my own DOT number. All I had to do was supply the DOT number of the carrier, and then I was able to run under my own IFTA authority.
Interesting. So you had your own IFTA account that you filed and filled out all the paperwork, but it was actually using the carrier's DOT number.
Yes, sir. It was in Texas. I actually did that with three motor carriers and was able to do it that way.
Well, you know, I never thought about that, so that's really good information. I used to do something similar when I would title my trucks in Ohio, if you had a DOT number, there was no sales tax. And I just used to use the DOT number of my carrier all the time, so kind of the same thing. So thanks for the heads up on that.
Okay, and then my questions is about IFTA and purchasing fuel. I've got my numbers, you know, pretty tight. And what I'm wondering is now to save more fuel, I hear a lot of people talk about not buying in states because IFTA is so high. I was to take the cost of IFTA out of my per gallon and buy fuel that way.
Just take those people out back and beat them senseless. They are almost always going to be wrong with that thinking. So let's go through why. So maybe people will... I haven't talked about this in a while on the air, but this is one of the most frustrating subjects I talk about because I can't seem to explain it really well on the air. Once you get it, you get it. And then you look around and go, my God, why doesn't everybody get this? It's simple. But when you're trying to explain it to somebody, it's not. But here's the thing. There are no absolutes. You can't ever say, well, it's always better to buy in this state. There are no absolutes because things change constantly. But once you understand the concept, you can make some generalization. And I will say, in general, the states with the highest IFTA tax are usually the best bargains for your fuel. So here's what happens. When you pull up to the pump, stick the hose in your tank and start pumping, and you have to go in and pay, the confusing part is you are paying for two totally different things. You are paying for the fuel you just put in your tank, but you are also paying a road tax, a fuel tax. I shouldn't call it a road tax. That'll confuse people. A fuel tax that changes from state to state. So you can't compare one state to the next by looking at the pump price. That it doesn't work. But here's what happens. The state sets the rate on fuel tax. So my favorite example is Florida and Georgia because there's always a big difference there, and those were the two states I used to run all the time, so I knew them really well. Here's what happens. Let's say that Florida's fuel tax is 10 cents a gallon higher than Georgia's, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but there's a big difference, and there's lots of states we could compare. So now the truck stop, let's say we're sitting right on the state line, and there's one truck stop in Georgia, and there's one truck stop in Florida. The truck stop in Florida is required to charge the higher fuel tax. There's nothing they can do about it. The truck stop in Georgia doesn't have to charge that much because the rate in Georgia is much lower. So what does the truck stop in Florida have to do to their fuel price? Since they can't change the tax, what do they have to do to their fuel price to be competitive with the truck stop in Georgia? They have to lower their fuel price.
Yeah.
Now, the truck stop in Georgia knows this, and they get to jack their price up and still look cheaper than Florida. So everybody stops at the last stop in Georgia to get their fuel, not knowing that they're paying more for the fuel than they need to. The tax doesn't matter. You just ignore the tax. Anything you overpay in tax, you're going to get back anyway. But when you overpay in fuel, you just overpaid. You're not getting anything back. So the way that So that's a generalization, saying that fuel in Florida is always cheaper than it is in Georgia. Every once in a while, that actually flip-flops, but it's pretty rare. But there are states where those numbers are closer together. So the only way to ever compare fuel prices, and I think you were alluding to this, is you take the pump price and you subtract the state tax rate in the state you're looking at, and that tells you how much you're paying for the fuel alone. Then you can compare fuel price anywhere you want and know where you're getting the cheapest fuel. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It's kind of what I was thinking. So, like, for Texas, and just say Texas and Louisiana, It's $1.20 a gallon in both states, and Texas is 20 cents a gallon for IFTA, and Louisiana is 19, then it's better to buy in Texas.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that would make, you've
got the math, and now that math works everywhere. And don't let anybody tell you there's an exception to the rule. There isn't. But they will point out states like Oregon and say, oh, that doesn't work in Oregon. Yeah, it does. Oregon doesn't have a fuel tax, so you can look at the pump price in Oregon, subtract zero because they don't have a fuel tax, and now use that price to compare against any other state. There are times when it makes total sense to buy your fuel in Oregon instead of Washington or California if you're traveling the I-5 corridor. They'll tell you, oh, that doesn't work in states like Indiana or Virginia because they have a fuel tax surcharge. Yes, they do, but just ignore it because it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect this calculation. Once you understand this calculation, it works everywhere.
Okay. One other question is, I know you talk about, 21 cents a mile for fuel is a good ideal. Is that before or after the tax rates?
That is all in. When we're trying to buy fuel, we always take the tax out. When we're doing profit and loss and looking at our business numbers, we just leave it in. Because it's in there, we have to pay it. We may get a refund, but it's usually not a big deal. So to keep things simple, we just leave it in, compare fuel price against fuel price.
Okay. Now, I know I'm running about 31 cents a mile. Got a horrible truck with the EGR valve. But my Litz truck app is saying that I'm running at 91 cents per mile. And I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, something is set wrong or something got entered wrong somewhere. The quickest way to fix that is just give us a call. We can go right into the account, and we're usually pretty good at finding that problem pretty quick and getting it fixed. Right now on the phone, on the air, not going to be able to do it, but if you call our office, we'll get it taken care of pretty quick. Let's go to Delaware. Robert, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. Thanks. I have a couple questions. First, about the Pittsburgh Power Box. I have a 2010 International ProStar. It's got a Cummins ISX. I got the horsepower at 550 and the torque at 1850. Run all over, and I average about around 7.5 miles to the gallon overall. Has no emissions on it either. What I'm wondering is what kind of fuel mileage increase I could actually seriously be looking at with a Pittsburgh Power Box on this truck.
Have you verified that they have one for that engine?
Not for sure, no.
And I say that because when they went through the EPA thing, they had to go back and test a lot of stuff, and I know they've been working through it, so I don't want to give you an answer and make it sound like I'm positive that they have one. So check with them first.
Okay.
But if they do, we see anywhere up to about 0.5 mile per gallon. And the reason it's kind of all over the board with the power box, there are times I see somebody put the power box on and lose fuel economy because all that power goes to their head and they start driving it, to impress people and get up the hill first. And if you do that, you're going to use more fuel. But if you drive the power box properly, I've seen a 0.5 mile per gallon increase, which is significant. So this is one of those modifications that it can improve fuel economy, but it really depends on you driving it properly. And it's going to put a smile on your face. So that's always fun, too, even if you don't abuse it. Well, there's the music. That means I've got to get out of here. So many questions, so little time. We'll come back and do it again. We'll see you then. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we are going to do an hour of Destination Health, an hour of general questions, and then at 4 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow we're going to do a special one-hour recording on brake issues. So plan on joining us for all of those things. We'll see you then.